From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, people who live and work around Troost discuss ideas for its revitalization.
You're just going down the street and they know your name, you know their name. Caring and trusting, I want to see children playing openly.
A local hospital tries to sell healthier food in its cafeteria with fast food right next door. And high school students debate the merits of urban romances.
When you read it, it feels so real, like you doing it yourself, like as if you put yourself in their shoes.
Plus, here are the members of a local 60s and 70s soul band, The Goodfoot.
I would have no complaints if I had lived through this the first time around.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Urban planners have just received their first assessment of what people who live and work in the Troost Corridor want from a multi-year makeover on a grand scale. KCUR's Dan Verbeck reports that more than 350 people listed concerns and hopes.
In groups of 8 and 10, they clustered at tables inside the Linwood Boulevard Scottish Rite Temple to help the United Way and the Greater Kansas City Area Chamber of Commerce plot this ambitious retooling of the East Side. The Urban Neighborhood Initiative, the UNI, will first revitalize an area from 23rd to 51st Streets, Troost to U.S. Highway 71. Concerns ranged from anti-crime security to educational opportunities. A brainstorming session with no right or wrong answers to the 3 to 5 changes people most want in their neighborhoods. Robert Scudder was there. He was allied with plans for a new school near 43rd and Troost.
Kind of community with family and friends, and more open doors, less need for locked doors, open porches where you're just going down the street and they know your name, you know their name. Caring and trusting, I want to see children playing openly.
United Way hopes to make this project a template for nationwide renewal of older city neighborhoods. Of some 11 people around this table, a vision for the community included having stores within walking distance, including a grocery. Gil Werner had the Green Impact Zone on his mind.
And have some significant demonstration projects for renewable energy, energy conservation, and sustainability. And have some models that people in the neighborhood can copy and become familiar with these concepts and incorporate them into their everyday life and routine. And I think we could become a model for the whole city.
Werner thinks the Green Zone has the money and it can be managed into his notions. Jan Wilner doesn't think the city codes will allow using recycled material for building structures, but she thinks it could be fashioned into art. She's one of several people in the group associated with the Emerald City Art Collective. Emily Drake has a succinct personal vision for the Troost Corridor community.
A sustainable and creative community that engages its people and provides opportunities for youth.
Drake elaborates that it should encompass education, recreation, and youth counseling. Maria Wheeler found she had concepts in common with a lot of people at the meeting, people she has never met.
We all work together. It's a lot easier to lift a community than to have, individuals trying to struggle on their own. It's a lot easier to help each other than it is to just help yourself. And in the process, you end up helping yourself. We all have the same philosophy around here.
In fact, the whole idea for this gathering was to collect basic ideas and ideals to give urban planners who will take on the initiative. It was a conversation about the Troost Corridor. United Way volunteer Julie Riddle kept it focused, and she drew out Robert Scudder again on taking care of youth, and then Bill Drummond on the crime issue, community perception that Troost is not a safe place. Robert Scudder's first.
An education center of any form, a place where they can go and learn something rather than be destructive, maybe learn how to be creative or whatever. I'm all about green energy, and I want to see some parks, some places where the kids can go play and I don't want to talk to my friend and tell him I live on 43rd and Truce in Kansas City, and he already knows that that is not a great place to be. I would rather him say, wow, that's amazing, you get to live there, than, oh, sorry about your luck.
So the reputation, you want the reputation to
change. I want Truce to shine.
I want a safe community. I want real security. There's two things in the world that are important. There's security and the perception of security. I want both.
These ideas will be culled and incorporated by planners taking on the project. It's led by Sylvia Robinson, who holds a doctorate in education, and she's not an urban architect in the conventional sense. And Robinson assures this is not like past failed projects that folded out of frustration or the immensity of the job. And she says it'll take years to accomplish. For KC Currents, I'm Dan Verbeck, KCUR News.
Truman Medical Center treated nearly 100,000 patients last year. But lately, hospital leaders have been trying to figure out ways to prevent people from getting sick and becoming patients in the first place. Truman CEO John Bluford has been waging a wellness campaign, promoting better nutrition and advising against eating junk food. So, what's a McDonald's doing right inside a main hospital entrance? KCUR's Alana Gordon reports.
It's lunchtime at Truman's main city campus, and with thousands of hungry employees, plus patients and visitors, the eating area is busy. You've basically got two options. Down the hallway from the hospital's entrance on Charlotte Street, people are ordering food in the main cafeteria.
Grilled turkey burger with pepper jack cheese and lots of onions.
A roast beef sandwich.
A salad. It's got some feta cheese, some chicken, your greens, strawberries.
I really like the soups.
But the first place you hit when you walk in the hospital is your other option.
I'm helping, please.
McDonald's.
I'm having two McChickens and a medium fry.
Quarter pounder.
I'm having a double cheeseburger.
Fries.
Fish sandwich and a Diet Coke. I've been craving it.
For Camille Berg, whose mom is in surgery, eating a juicy, familiar burger hits the spot.
It's more convenient.
For Truman CEO John Bluford, who's been trying to make nutritious food more widely available, deciding where to eat isn't hard.
I think I'm going to have some green beans, please.
I recently caught up with him for lunch in the cafeteria.
And I'd like to try this roasted chicken today.
Bluford says hospitals need to be setting the example for healthy lifestyles and diet. More than half of patients coming to Truman have at least one chronic disease. And region-wide, about 1 in 4 residents is obese. 1 in 4 has high blood pressure.
You are what you eat. I think it's critical. And many of our disease elements are diabetes, hypertension, congested heart failure. Good nutrition has a significant impact on each of those diseases.
As chair last year of the American Hospital Association, Bluford issued a call to action, mapping out how hospitals can serve as better leaders of wellness. At Truman, that's translated to a lot of things. Fitness and nutrition tips are now posted on elevators and hallways and in staff emails. Baked chips have replaced regular ones in vending machines. The hospital launched a seasonal farmers market and is working to open a full-service grocery store a few blocks away where affordable fresh produce is hard to come by. Another visible change took place right here in the cafeteria. It was remodeled about a year and a half ago.
Beets and carrots.
The salad bars expanded. That case full of cakes and pies, gone. Now you can still get burgers, cookies, even fries. But the hospital's food vendor, Morrison, says it's now using less sugar, sodium, and fat in a lot of the food it prepares. Some people really appreciate the changes. Eric Frankel, a pharmacist at Truman, is a fan of the low-calorie options.
I'm able to maintain and possibly lose some weight by going there every day.
How are you ladies doing?
Fine.
Good.
Bluford and I sit down for lunch in an employee section. About 10 feet in front of us is the wall to the McDonald's. I ask him about this. we pause from eating.
Not good.
Bluford says there's a place for fast food, but having it in the hospital, at a main entrance no less, goes against the core of his wellness campaign.
When you come in, you could be very well be on the way to your diabetic clinic appointment or going to see the bariatric surgeon for your weight problem, and you're passing a McDonald's on the way. That's an inconsistent message.
Truman's not the only health center that has a McDonald's. They're in 27 hospitals around the country. Bluford says 20 years ago, when this McDonald's lease was signed, putting fast food establishments in hospitals was a popular trend. It made sense from a business standpoint.
One, because there wasn't the kind of emphasis on healthy eating and size management of portions, portion management, I guess I should say. And those franchises used to pay a nice penny to lease the space. So hospitals needed the revenue. And that's no different than what happened at Truman Medical Centers in 1992.
Under the terms of the contract signed at that time, which is public record, McDonald's pays Truman rent plus 8% of its annual gross sales over $1 million. The lease is for up to 25 years, with McDonald's making the decision every 5 years whether to renew it. This means McDonald's could exercise its final 5-year renewal soon. Bluford didn't want to talk about details of the deal, but he says in the last year he's been looking into replacing the restaurant. Both the McDonald's Corporation and the local owner declined KCUR's requests for interviews about the situation, but they did issue some statements. McDonald's says it's proud of its menu and the evolving choices offered at the restaurant. It's not about where you eat, the company says, but what and how much you choose to consume. As for Ralph King, the owner of the McDonald's at Truman, he owns 5 other McDonald's in the region. He's been involved in several local organizations, including the Heartland Black McDonald's Operators Association, which has been championed by the Black Healthcare Coalition for its support of several health initiatives and for its reinvestment in the community. Outside on Charlotte Street, right in front of the McDonald's and the cafeteria, Kina Olsley waits for a ride after her prenatal visit. She says it's nice to have a choice between a burger from McDonald's or a salad or pizza from the cafeteria.
So you got both, you know, and most people want a variety, so I don't see nothing wrong with it.
Charles Henderson, a 38-year-old with 2 broken ankles, sits nearby in a wheelchair. He just finished 2 chicken sandwiches from McDonald's. He says he's not sure whether the restaurant should be at Truman. But at the same time, McDonald's tastes better, and it's quick and cheap.
I like that it's greasy and hot, and it's a 99 cents. You know what I mean, I like the deals they got.
The hospital hopes its wellness efforts will make it easier for employees, patients, and the community to make healthy choices. But within its doors, at least for now, food options will still include a quarter pounder, fries, and a Coke. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
Coming up, Kansas City, Kansas high school students talk about the value and danger in racy literature. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
In recent years, there's been a renaissance of books about tough inner city life, which are popular with teen audiences. The genre has been called urban fiction, hip-hop fiction, or ghetto lit, and it's often filled with profanity, sex, violence, and illegal activity. Some of the popular titles include Thugs and the Women Who Love Them, Hooker to Housewife, and Golden Hustler. While the genre seems to keep a technology-saturated generation reading, the content of these books is troubling to a lot of parents and teachers. I recently visited Washington High School, where I talked to some students and a teacher about urban literature.
I'm Cara Bryant, and I'm a sophomore here at Washington High School. I don't know. It's like when you're reading it, it feels so real, like you doing it yourself, like as if you put yourself in their shoes. And like what you see in the real world is what she's telling you in the book, so that's why I like it.
I'm Brooklyn Cummings. I learn how other people handle situations, and that tells me how to handle situations differently than how books handle it. Like, not to cuss even though when you're mad, and not to get out of control and fight.
I'm Sydney. Most kids, they're not able to tell their parents certain things, and they're not able to let them know how they feel. So I think that the books really do help in many ways. In some cases, I personally have learned some things from reading those books, how to get over being in a relationship and how to move on from it and taking it day by day, step by step.
My name is Brandy Stout. I'm a journalism teacher at Washington High School. I don't know that it's necessarily a question of should they read what they want to read, because they're teenagers. Teenagers are going to read what they want to read, regardless of our opinions as adults. I think parents have some influence, and sometimes teachers might have some influence, but when it comes right down to it, students are going to read whatever they want to read.
One Washington High student, Michaela Krause, won an award from the Kansas Scholastic Press Association for her article on urban fiction called Freedom to Read. She says she was inspired to write about the controversy when she heard one teacher's reaction to a popular urban fiction book.
Colonel McCormick was he was shocked that students were reading books that were really graphic in nature, and he was surprised at the content and the age that people were reading them at.
So have you ever read one of these books?
I read parts. Winita Clark, The Golden Hustler. I read that one.
What'd you think?
It was interesting. The storyline was different from what I normally read. I kind of like the mysteries or the murders or solve this, and it was a little different. There was some content, but nothing that I haven't seen in other books.
So what are the two sides here?
The sides are kind of that maybe it's not the most age-appropriate material and that it should be rated, like our video games and our TV shows. And the other side is if it gets kids reading, maybe it will help them grow. And the idea that we can't rate books because of the First Amendment.
As a journalist, you had to stay fair and balanced and right down the middle. But personally, what do you think about these books since you read The Golden Hustler?
Well, I even know as a kid, I read books that were maybe what some people would have thought out of my age group. And if someone would have told me, like, oh, you can't read this, this is too old for you, I would have found a way to read it. So that was kind of where I was coming at it. I understood where the students were kind of coming from with their idea of, like, they didn't want to hear someone tell them not to read the book. And even if they told them you can't read it, they would go find a place to read it. And I would have done the same thing. I might not have read it in their class, but I would have gone and read it on my own time.
So in a way, it's kind of futile trying to censor students from reading certain books.
Yes, I would agree.
What kind of conclusion should we draw about the different sides?
I think students know, kids know in general what they're comfortable with. Their parents have talked to them about it, and I think most students and kids have that relationship with their parents now that they can kind of talk to their parents, or if not, they have someone they can talk to. So I think it's open for them to read what they want to read, and they obviously picked it up because they found something they can relate to.
Now, in talking to students, what do you think they relate to in these books?
The thing that I got that came across with them was that the books we read in class are older. They're The Great Gatsby and Native Son of Mice and Men. And they're books that don't really relate to the things and the issues that are going on right now. The issues that we face now are a lot different than the issues we faced when people wrote Great Gatsby. That was about Prohibition. And
Great Expectations.
Yeah, or The Great Expectations, or Of Mice and Men. The different things we read now are kind of outdated. And a lot of the books that come out now are more they talk about the social aspect and the idea of cyberbullying and different stuff that kids experience now.
So what do you say to adults who say, oh my God, these kids are reading about sex, they're reading about violence, they're reading about illegal things. Isn't this going to make them want to go out and try these things?
How I feel kind of is we see it out there. We see it on TV. We hear it. I mean, it's always on the news. The idea that someone was, you know, a woman was attacked on her way home, or there's teen pregnancies on the rise. We see it. We know it's out there. You kind of experience it, or you get to see it one way or another.
Most Washington High students seem to support urban fiction, but many parents and educators have wondered if high school students and middle school students should be allowed to read the books. Should libraries assign movie-style ratings to urban fiction? The West Wyandotte branch of the Kansas City, Kansas Library is a source of a lot of these books for young readers, and staff says they have no plans to change that.
I'm Laura Lovelace, a branch manager of the West Wyandotte Library. The role of a library is to provide as much diverse material for as diverse of a population as we have. And so we serve about 150,000 people here. We don't all read the same thing. And we spend our money the best way we know how to reach as many of those 150,000 people that we possibly can. And people have a wide range of interest. Is urban literature something that I want to read? No. It doesn't interest me in the least. But then I don't want to read vampire books. I don't want to read about zombies. I don't want to read erotica. There's a lot of things I don't want to read. That doesn't mean that I infringe on your right to not have access to those materials.
Now, as a librarian, is there a lot of demand for urban lit? Do kids come in and check it out? Or
I'm Linda Bowman. I'm the Young Adult Associate here at West Wyandotte Library. I believe that it's getting checked out. It's not in the young adult collection. It's very rare for a young person to ask us where it is because they in their heads know that their parents may not approve. But they will ask us for an author and we'll take them to it.
So that's usually how they find it.
Oh, yes. Their word of mouth is the way that teens read. If one reads a book that they think is fantastic, they'll tell all their friends, and then all their friends will read it too.
So I've heard some parents and some teachers say, these books should be rated if they're in a library, just like we do movies or we do other things. What are your thoughts?
Well, ALA's position is we don't rate any sort of material. We buy movies and music for our collection. It may come with a rating system. That is not a rating system that we use. And that we abide by ALA's Library Bill of Rights as much as we possibly can. And so we do label some things genre-wise. We put a mystery label in there, a romance, some things like that. But as for saying anything about the nature of the content and whether it's appropriate or inappropriate for certain age groups, we don't do anything like that. It's the founding principles of libraries are intellectual freedom, the right to access material, the freedom to read what you want to read. And it goes right along with the freedom of speech. You have a right to say what you want, write what you want, read what you want, access what you want.
Do you think then that people don't always understand that about libraries?
Oh, absolutely. I think people think that we are censors, but it's okay when they come in and we have something they want. You know, they don't think about it in terms of the opposite end of that spectrum. If one of the most challenged books of all times is the Bible, and we have quite a nice Bible collection up there. And if people came in and we decided not to buy it because we didn't feel it was appropriate, then they would be really upset with that chain of thought, too. And so, you know, they don't think about it in those terms. It's only when something is controversial that they particularly disagree with, and they don't always think about what somebody else might disagree with. And so it is hard for people. But I will say, though, that I think this is a very open-minded community, and people pass up things they don't want to read to pick up the things that they do, and they're okay with having those other items on the shelf.
However the urban fiction controversy plays out, it seems unlikely to affect one thing: teenagers' appetite for gritty, hard-edged books.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. When farmers are facing foreclosure or bankruptcy, their options can seem limited or downright intimidating. But that's not always the case. Mediation services may offer a more cost-effective and less stressful route compared with an expensive legal trek through the courts. The Kansas Agricultural Mediation Services was created in 1988 to help farmers during the farm crisis of the time. But it remains an important service today. The program provides free and reduced-cost financial counseling and legal advice, as well as mediation services. Harvest Public Media's Eric Durbin recently spoke with Forrest Bueller, staff attorney for CAMS.
I think what you see in agriculture quite a bit, mediation in other areas is often kind of a one-on-one with the person that you're in conflict with. In agriculture, we'll see more multi-party mediations. There will be not only a bank involved, for example, but also the local seed dealer and fuel supplier, and also government agencies. Many of the agricultural loans that are made have a basis in USDA. The USDA Farm Loan Program provides not only direct loans to farmers, but also guarantees loans through private banks. And so in agricultural situations, it's a little different because at the beginning of those types of mediations, you're generally going to have many people involved and with different interests and all associated with agriculture, but the number of parties involved and how that all fits together in a rural community is a unique part of agricultural mediation.
In your experience, is there a level of anxiety there or fear at all?
Very much so. I think anxiety is a good way to put it. From the farmer's perspective, this involves his livelihood. Whatever decision, whether it's an agency decision or that of a lender or a creditor that's trying to collect their debt that the farmer can't afford to pay, there is an anxiety level that it certainly could be a loss of operation, a loss of what he's been able to do with his own operation. So that's always there. And there's also the sense of, one of our mediators calls it kind of rural economic development in terms of what mediation is. Because, as you probably know, the farmer has not only a loan at the bank, but an account at the co-op, at the fuel place, the repair place, the implement dealer. The whole community is involved in that sense. So getting the farmer to look at things realistically and objectively so that they can then talk with their lender about that takes some of the anxiety out of the farmer as well. Because oftentimes, they just don't know where to start.
And have you seen that the kind of same level of preparedness or understanding, has that been the same for the older generation of farmers as well as the new generation of farmers that are coming onto the farm today?
I think you'll see a better understanding of what a producer needs to have in order to be successful in the younger generation. Sometimes we see kind of the opposite of the younger generation, because they have more knowledge, is maybe willing to take more risk than the older generation in that respect. One of the things, for example, that we've been seeing a need for over the past 4 or 5 years is, and that we've been doing more of, is farm family mediations, where there's a transition from the older generation to the younger generation. There are often, as I said, value conflicts. There are often trying to figure out how to incorporate the younger generation into a farm. Can we do that to begin with? Do we need to expand? What's the entity going to look like so that mom and dad can retire and bring the new generation on and still have money for the entire family to be profitable and comfortable? We've been doing more farm family mediations. Oftentimes emotions and disagreements and different values, even petty disputes that have basically brewed over many years, can get in the way of making that kind of a good decision. So mediation and the different services that we have can help families look at that and see which get past those and try and find ways that will make a good business decision out of that transition.
That was Forrest Bueller, a staff attorney for the Kansas Agricultural Mediation Services. He spoke to Harvest Public Media's Eric Durbin. It's hard today to conjure up a time when the United States and China didn't have trade relations or communicate at all. But in 1972, President Richard Nixon's visit to China, a once demonized communist regime, was heralded as the week that changed the world. It opened communication between the two countries after more than two decades of hostility. A new production of the opera, Nixon in China, explores the tension and symbolism of that visit. KCUR's Laura Spencer reports.
Let's take a step back to 1987. Ward Holmquist was the assistant conductor at Houston Grand Opera for the world premiere of composer John Adams' first opera, Nixon in China. He recalls it was a formidable assignment.
I've had very few scores in my professional life that have presented the kind of rhythmic challenges that this one presents. And I truly enjoyed the experience, but it was one of the most difficult pieces that I've ever learned how to play.
Holmquist is now the Lyric Opera of Kansas City's artistic director. He says the score of Nixon in China has hints of pop and jazz, but the strongest element, the composer's sense of rhythm, a minimalist pulse.
This is a pulsing and throbbing and rather intricately crafted score from a rhythmic point of view, and it gives all of the musicians, both the singers and the orchestral members, and of course the conductor, much to do in order to bring everything together and line it up.
Holmquist and the Lyric's general director, Evan Luskin, talked about presenting Nixon in China in Kansas City for years, looking for the right time and the right production. And they found it in a new version conceived by Canadian director Michael Cavanaugh. His production is dynamic, with film footage projected onto scrolls that drop from the ceiling, exaggerated towering red chairs and podiums.
It has a fantastic structure. You know, as a dramaturge, as a dramatic editor, I look at the way the piece is built, and this in these six scenes spread over three acts, it just has the most amazing structure where a kind of reality establishes each setting and then fractures off in earlier and more dramatically as the piece goes on.
The opera begins with the arrival of Air Force One in Beijing, then called Peking. Computer-generated imagery of the plane transitions into a full-scale model on stage. President Richard Nixon walks on the tarmac to shake hands with the Chinese premier. Scenes of the historic trip unfold, a meeting in Mao's study, a large banquet, and First Lady Pat Nixon on a public relations tour. Kavanaugh says the documentary aspect of it is a jumping-off point. It's really about where reality meets dreams.
It's about how human beings tend to view the epic events of their lives.
At a Lyric Opera rehearsal, a trio of Mao's secretaries open the second scene of Act Two. The Nixons are invited to watch a revolutionary ballet. In it, a peasant girl is treated harshly by her landlord. And Pat Nixon, soprano Maria Kanyova, gets caught up in the action. Her husband, Richard Nixon, baritone James Maddalena, who originated the role, reminds her that it's just a play. The libretto, written by poet Alice Goodman, is in rhymed couplets. It's a challenge for singers, along with the shifting time signatures.
Maria Kanyova, who's played Pat Nixon a handful of times, says there are wide skips and leaps, but it feels natural to her.
I think it's just more about comfort. It's about just letting the role kind of sing itself rather than trying so hard to make it work and so hard to, you know, vocalize it.
The Lyric's artistic director, Ward Holmquist, says he's been dying to conduct the score for 25 years. And he says director Michael Cavanaugh's take on it is true to the spirit of the original production. But now that the moment is here, there's a little anxiety.
This is probably the farthest we have stuck our neck out artistically as a company thus far. So I'm very pleased that we can present it, and I'm very curious to see what the reaction is going to be from our audience.
But he says Kansas City audiences would not have been able to see this production without the Lyric's move to the larger stage in the Kauffman Center. After its run in Kansas City, it travels to San Francisco. Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
The first cut, on a
The Lyric Opera of Kansas City presents Nixon in China through March 18th at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. More information and photos can be found on our website at kcur.org. Just click on Arts and Culture.
After the break, Kansas City soul cover band The Goodfoot is releasing some original songs. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Kansas Republicans prepared for the caucuses, which were won by Rick Santorum. Missouri legislators argued over Rush Limbaugh. And all charges were dropped against five men in a high-profile sex abuse case. Steve Bell revisits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
2 years after the first allegations of child sex abuse were made against six men in the Burl Moeller family, all charges against the five still living were dropped. Rebecca Randalls, attorney for the alleged victims, told TV9 she thought Lafayette County Prosecutor Kelly Wingate Campbell had some explaining to do.
There's never been any indication that she didn't believe what the victims were saying.
The prosecutor said she did believe the accusations, but didn't believe she had the evidence to make a case in court. Plans by Missouri House leadership to induct Rush Limbaugh into the Hall of Famous Missourians created an uproar after Limbaugh repeatedly called a Georgetown University law student a slut and a prostitute for advocating mandatory health coverage for contraception.
It will be embarrassing for us to have this gentleman in our Hall of Fame,
said Democratic House member Sarah Lampe. House Speaker Stephen Tilley responded,
"Listen, it's not the Hall of University Love Missourians. It's the Hall of Famous Missourians."
Democratic Minority Leader Mike Talboy suggested if it was about notoriety, Frank and Jesse James should be included. The matter of students who want to transfer out of the unaccredited Kansas City School District was left up in the air until at least next fall, when the Missouri Supreme Court overturned a St. Louis court's order that such students were entitled to an immediate transfer. The matter was sent back to the St. Louis judge because of legal technicalities, not a ruling on the state's transfer law. Rick Santorum made his pitch to Johnson County Republicans before the weekend Kansas caucuses and had a comeback for Mitt Romney, who had just said it would take an act of God to stop his momentum.
If the governor thinks he's, you know, now ordained by God to win, then let's just have it out.
Romney skipped Kansas. Ron Paul campaigned in Lawrence and Wichita. The Missouri legislature left for spring break, and House leadership said it had accomplished 70% of its agenda. But so far, the combined chambers have sent Governor Nixon only two bills, and he may very well veto them both.
We're one of three legs of government. The problem that we have is that a lot of times we think we're the only leg. And then we spend a whole nother year not getting anything done,
remarked Democrat Sylvester Taylor about a work comp bill virtually identical to one Governor Nixon vetoed last year. The other bill sent to Nixon's desk redefines discriminatory firing, stating that discrimination must be the motivating factor for the firing to be actionable. Nixon also vetoed a bill very similar to that one last year. Before adjourning for the break, House budget writers finalized a budget bill Kansas City's Ryan Silvey noted that the process moves fast when the state has little money to spend.
Last year, I think we disposed of 9 amendments across all 13 bills, got it done in about an hour and a half, something like that.
The Kansas House Budget Committee was also ramping up its work. Symbolic groundbreaking was held for a $32 million addition to the UMKC Block School of Business. Henry Block himself was a major contributor.
At my age, I figured to have a fundraising campaign would take a long time, and I don't even know how successful it would be, but I just decided, let me help out.
The new building will be called the Block Executive Hall for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. This is KCUR.
One of Kansas City's up-and-coming bands isn't jazz, rock, or country. Their audience isn't young or old, black or white, but a pretty diverse mix. And they've just now started writing their own songs. The Goodfoot is a 7-piece soul cover band, and they want to get you moving. Casey Currents' Kayla Regan attended their CD release party a few weeks ago at the Uptown.
Hundreds of people are at the 2012 Carnival du Sol, many of them dressed in their Mardi Gras best, which means a lot of feathers, wigs, and face paint. One couple's costume involves a light display. Anyways, these people are getting crazy to the Goodfoot, one of the headliners tonight. And as usual, the band brings it, at least according to the crowd.
You know, I'm glad I brought my dancing shoes tonight. That's all I gotta say about that. I was dancing, but normally I would never dance.
Yeah, I've seen them many, many times, and every time it's better than the last.
This is actually my first time, and I love it. So awesome.
Oh my God, it was amazing. I don't know really what to say, but I just thought it was amazing because I knew like half the songs, and I could dance to it any way I wanted to, and start swinging with my partner over here.
Vocalist Julia Hale is sporting an afro and a tight-fitting mini dress. She's petite and gorgeous, and she looks like she belongs on stage.
Thank you! So some ladies dancing and singing to that one. Mm-hmm. I love you too, Balcony.
Week after week, the Goodfoot recreates that old soul sound. The band started after keyboardist Adam Wagner and guitarist Tim Braun were part of a play about Janis Joplin a few years back. They were around so much Motown and soul music, it just made sense to start a soul cover band. Wagner says they all grew up with the music, and he and Hale have a deep admiration for it.
It's always staggering to me how the volume of great stuff that happened between like 65 and 75. It's just like that's a 10-year stretch, just... Most of the things that I like happened.
Yeah, pretty bad musically music anyway. For a solid decade. Yeah.
And if they could, they'd probably go back to that time.
I would have no complaints if I had lived through this the first time around.
Yeah.
I mean,
I might have some complaints if I was living through it the first time around, but I think I'd have a lot of fun.
So they got some of their friends and people they knew would be interested together. Almost right away, the Goodfoot was a hit. Wagner remembers their first show at the Czar Bar.
And it was shoulder-to-shoulder people. I feel like everybody was ready for a band like us to exist.
By October 2008, the Goodfoot was officially formed. Hale knows this, by the way, because
I pulled up a random video of a show we did a long time ago, and we won a trophy for it, and our drummer sang October 08, so it's been like
going on four years.
I was like, what? That's a long time.
Oh, man, I forgot all about that.
Yeah.
We're drinking champagne out of a trophy cup.
Yeah. It was...
Wagner says there really weren't many soul or Motown cover bands in Kansas City when they got started. He says people wanted something they could recognize and dance and sing along to. Julia Hale says it helps that they play all ages shows, so anyone can go and expect to have a great time.
You know, there are going to be some tunes that of that era that you love, and they'll pop up, and that's my favorite moment at a show, when I see someone who like hasn't been moving the whole time, and then we play one song by one artist, and they're like up dancing. Like, it just hits them, and then they want to move to it.
Hale and Wagner have seen it all from the stage, and it seems like that's one of their favorite parts of performing.
People just switch. Like, it's a lot of fun to watch. Like, a certain song comes on, and they just, like, look at me, and they're like, oh, my God! Like, they get so excited. It's so much fun, and I laugh sometimes, but it's joy.
It's funny the things you pick up on from stage, too.
Yeah.
These things range from guys hitting on girls, successfully and unsuccessfully, to domestic squabbles. And once, in a testament to the power of music,
one guy proposed to his girlfriend, like, in the middle of the set. Like, he was like, I'm going to propose to her. This is the perfect moment. We're having such a great time. Like, I was like, oh, my God, that's awesome. Go for it. Like, people like the atmosphere that we kind of create with the tunes and makes them want to take on life, I guess.
To Adam Wagner, one of the biggest rewards of being on stage is exposing some of the lesser-known soul songs to a wider audience.
For us, there was a lot of homework done as far as, you know, old soul music. We've listened to a lot of it and sifted through a lot of it to try to develop our set. And I enjoy
the lesser known.
Yeah, I enjoy knowing that people are maybe experiencing it for the first time.
Part of the reason for the success of the Good Foot is that they bring you what you want to hear, those classic moments and songs that bring you back to where you were when you first heard them. They play James Brown, Jackson 5, and Aretha Franklin. In fact, they know enough material to fill a 4-hour set. And then, without you even noticing, they slip in their own little touches.
But it wouldn't be nothing, nothing. Without a woman or a girl. I think in each song we do, everyone has their own thing that they do now. Like, that's different from the original, but we've solidified in this band, and it's really cool to hear those moments. And then going back and listening to the songs in their original state, I'm like, whoa, we don't do that, or we do that there, and we don't do that. Like, it's cool to see how things have evolved.
So when it comes time for me to sing a part in a song where it's like an Otis Redding song or something, I'm really trying to put myself there, like,
Otis. Yeah, come on, Otis.
Be with me tonight.
Now, with shows booked every week and over 2,000 friends on Facebook, the Good Foot is evolving too. They're writing and performing their own songs. And maybe surprisingly, they're not too worried about it.
We're pretty lucky in Kansas City. We've got just a ton of local love, you know. That I feel like people trust that what we're going to do is going to be good enough mm-hmm. for them, you know.
Yeah.
that we've done our homework, and that we've, you know, we've been playing this stuff long enough that we're at least qualified to start
to try some of
doing
our own
thing.
In a way, learning all the cover songs and mastering the performances was kind of practice for what they're doing now. They want their songs to be as good as the ones that they cover. So what better way to get there than to start with the originals?
It was like, okay, well, let's get this stuff under our belts and then, you know, start trying to do our own stuff. And there's been a number of tunes that kind of didn't make the cut, you know, that we thought we had it down and then something just didn't quite fit right.
Yeah.
And we just kind of let it be. Because, I mean, again, we have a pretty high standard to live up to, you know, when you're talking about all these great bands, Booker T and the MGs, and
we want to be as great as those bands that we're playing now, you know, and I think the transition can be really smooth with what we're writing and what we're giving to them as ours, so I think that's the goal.
Now the Good Foot has about 5 or 6 new songs ready to perform and a music video for their single House. They're working on building up their fan base in the Midwest. Besides their regular gigs, they're playing the Kansas City Spring Dance on May 5th, which they're pretty excited for. And at the Uptown show a few weeks ago, they released their newest original single, Bad Way.
I mean, it's a dancing tune. We want people to It's got those classic elements of, you know, need you, want you, baby, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that music has lasted for 50 plus years for a reason.
Yeah, really.
And judging by the crowd the night of their release party, it looks like they'll be just fine doing their own thing. For Casey Currents, this is Kayla Regan.
We're going out today with the Goodfoots' new single, Bad Way. For a link to their website or to see about upcoming shows, go to Casey Current's page on our website, kcur.org.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia, with assistant producer Alex Smith. Kayla Regan and Carrie Coogan are our interns. Our theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.